don't think there is such a thing as a good war. There are sometimes necessary wars. And I think one might say just wars. And that I never questioned the necessity of that war, and I still do not question it. It was something that had to be done.
That was one of the veterans featured in Ken Burns' 7-part, 15-hour epic documentary, The War, which premiered this past Sunday on PBS. He is stating one of the main themes of the film, that although World War II is often called the good war, reality is a lot more complicated. I'm very pleased to welcome Ken Burns back to the show, along with Lynn Novick, his co-director and co-producer on the series. Hello.
Thank you so much.
It's interesting that the title of the documentary is The War. In Europe, people would take that to mean World War I, wouldn't they? And in the United States, many people probably would say, oh, that's the Civil War.
Or the one we're in right now is mm-hmm. more often what we had. I think that what Lynn and I wanted to do was, first of all, honor the people who were in it, who call it to this day the war.
And they call it the war, too.
And if you take a little bit of an aerial view on the horrific 20th century, they're going to call it the war as well, because it is the worst of them all. But we also know that one of the things we were getting at was an experience of what war is like. And while it is, of course, unique to the circumstances and the place and the people of that particular conflict, there is also something generic about it. There is also something true. There's a kind of fellowship that only soldiers know, and that's what we're also after.
Isn't it also one of those dividing lines in the same way that the Civil War was a dividing line? When we say post-war economy, everybody knows we mean post-World War II economy, not post-Korean War, no, not post-Vietnam War.
It's such a milestone in the history of the 20th century, and especially in the history of the United States in some ways, because our country before, during, and after probably would be somewhat unrecognizable. The country before was in the Depression, and it was really sort of backwards in a lot of ways. Our army was very small. Our factories were not doing very much. People were really not well-educated, a lot of people. There wasn't a lot of jobs and food. And then the war came, and the country was completely transformed. The economy started booming. People started moving around. They left their small towns. They met new people. It invigorated the society in such a huge way. And it was also a huge trauma for the people that were involved in fighting it.
Some of the past documentaries, like Baseball and Jazz, filled a certain historical void, although there were other histories. Nobody had really put it all together in the way the series did. But World War II is there's a History Channel that seems to just one World War II documentary after another. So you had to find a way to make it fresh, or were you trying to tell a different kind of story?
We were trying to tell a different kind of story, and a priori that we think that would make it fresh. And you're absolutely right. We could have been excused from doing this. But I think that if you look at the whole basket of other stuff, it has not, first of all, benefited from a public television treatment, which means we're permitted to have 6+ years to figure out how to tell the story and to do it well.
And that have a lot of time to tell.
To go into the archives, to develop the characters, all of that. But it also means that we're able to get at the thing that we're looking for, which is a bottom-up experience, and not be distracted by all the stuff that gets in the way of World War II documentaries, the generals, the politicians who don't do the fighting and dying, the strategy, the tactics, the armaments, all the stuff that gets in the way, even the interest in the evil Nazis that often metastasize into some admiration, and we were trying to liberate ourselves, and we hope our audience from that.
You could certainly argue that it's such an important subject, it will never be finished. There will always be new angles and new ways to look at it, and we were very aware of all the things that have been done so well. We didn't try to make the world at war again. That's been done. It's a brilliant series. What we really looked at was what hadn't been done, and one of the things that we felt was that because the population of veterans has aged and getting closer to the end of their lives, their grandchildren are starting to ask them what the war was like, and they're opening up a little bit more. So we had kind of a little window of opportunity. You know, 10 years ago, they really weren't ready to talk, and 10 years from now, they won't be around. So we had this moment to sort of say, what hasn't been done about the war? And because letters were censored, because you couldn't keep a diary, to find out the sort of experiential truth of the war, you have to hear it from the people who were actually there, and you can see it in their faces and how they tell their stories.
So was that something that actually happen to you when you ask people to talk about the war? Were they much more open than they've been over the last 50 years with their families?
Well, according to their families, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people really hadn't discussed much of anything for many, many years and had started slowly to open up. And sometimes they had sort of gotten the hang of talking about it, but they hadn't delved that deeply into what the feelings they had at that time and how it still affected them today.
Do you think it's one of the reasons that this war has been kind of glamorized? I mean, there we can talk about any number of reasons. First of all, we start off with the whole phrase, the good war. I think Studs Terkel came up with it. Do you think it's partly because Americans remember it with less ambivalence than any of our other wars except the Revolutionary War?
That's exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. But it's what happens to all wars. There's something in the hard wiring of human beings that gets a few years out from a war, and all of a sudden it is susceptible to this disease of mythologizing. It is susceptible to this sense that, okay, blood wasn't shed, arms weren't lost, guts weren't spilled, heads didn't explode, but something else took place, and that we can just talk about that. Let's agree, it happened in the Civil War, it happened in the Second World War, and it seems incumbent upon us to honor the experience of these people before they pass from the scene by saying heads exploded, guts spilled, arms were lost, lives, blood
was
shed.
I mean, war is so inherently horrible, and then when subsequently to the Second World War, our country has been involved in a number of wars that were very horrible and also didn't end well for us. And so I think there's a great need to think about a war that we feel, yes, it was horrible, but it had the outcome that we would have wanted.
But when we look at the popular culture, the way it dealt with those other wars, generally there have been negative images that we've gotten, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, even the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War. Hollywood has been really tough on America. It is part of the revisionist impulse, but not World War II. And yet one of the things that you want to deal with here is that it was the worst war, and it also had a really dark side.
It did. It did, and we're curious about not only why it is that this stuff gets swamped and overwhelmed by the mythology, but would it be possible to tell a story in which we didn't ourselves descend into the small p petty politics of the dialectic of it, but got into what the experience of it was? It's the worst war ever, of course, because 60 million people perhaps lost their lives, and in that kind of transformation, all sorts of varieties of suffering were invented or perpetuated, and I think that the film does that. I think we felt that rather than succumb ourselves to adopting a political stance, it might be possible to simply bear witness to what happened and to allow everyone else to fill in their feelings about it. So a battle that may come down to us with so much familiarity, like an Omaha Beach, or something that's relatively unknown, like a Peleliu, now just gets, here it is. And then you have a chance to respond.
Well, is there anybody who doesn't think that this was a just and necessary war? People will question the rationales behind other wars. But, okay, we'll agree that it was the worst war because so many people died.
It's interesting how many questions, not too much, but we get a lot of questions along the way that want to parse a lot of different things. From Pearl Harbor, what did we know? Did Roosevelt deliberately get us into it? He knew it was coming.
Did the vets ask those questions?
No. No, it's more the abstract, it's the convenience, it's the luxury. These people created a world in which we spend a lot of time abstracting things, all the way from Pearl Harbor to the atomic bomb, which inevitably gets taken out and abstract as much as anything. And we were just, in some ways, and I think Lynn can really speak to this well, particularly about the bomb, we're unwilling to divorce the circumstances from its adjacent or even just related context.
My guests are Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, who are the co-directors and co-producers of The War, which began on Sunday, September 23rd on PBS, and will be running throughout the next couple of weeks. It's 15 hours long. And so you're saying, Lynn, in effect, you were trying to demystify how we see World War II, try to separate the reality, both the positive and the negative, from all the mythology that
has
been attached to it?
I mean, you've said it perfectly. I think the thing that we were curious to discover ourselves, and I speak for myself, not knowing all the gory details of what the war was really like, is that when you sort of peel back the curtain and you start to explore what the true nature of the killing that went on and what our side had to do to win the war and what the other side did and all of that, it's very murky. It's not so clear-cut. Yes, the war was just. Yes, we had to fight it. Yes, we had to win it. But in the course of doing that, many, many, many terrible things were done.
In fact, you start off with the first show deals with the Japanese treatment of American soldiers in the Philippines, which turns out to be incredibly brutal. And you say is the result of a different attitude toward war and a philosophy about whether you surrender or not.
That's right. And we were, I think, part of the horror for us working on this. We are hearing the testimonies of, in this case, Glenn Frazier, who has survived the Bataan Death March. And as he said, I would have chosen death if I knew what I was about to go through. And of course, the next scene is about the internment of Japanese Americans in the United States.
And because so, the atrocities on both sides. In fact, Americans did a lot more than intern the Japanese. We committed a fair number of awful things, usually justifying them by saying, well, the Japanese did it or the Germans did it, so why shouldn't
There's
we?
There's so many levels to this that it becomes almost meaningless to ascribe to a particular nationality what happens. War is a brutal affair. It's the lie of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of this war, we engaged with our allies in systematic extermination of civilians through an air war. I mean, this was the strategy.
And the Germans now, in fact, want to talk about what happened in the bombings in Tokyo and in Germany as war crimes.
And you know, if you watch Errol Morris's Fog of War, you have Robert McNamara, one of the designers of the air strikes, saying that if we had lost, we would be tried as war criminals. So what you begin to understand is this uncivilized thing that war is. And in our first episode, Sunday night, we have this kid who turns from 17 to 18 in Guadalcanal looking at the camera, the 80-plus years dissolving off his face as you feel with his archival picture this youth again. And he's saying, I don't remember taking any prisoners after he had discovered Americans mutilated and ambushed. And so you suddenly realize this is not the war in which there's a, you know, look, we are the good guys. I mean, that was the other thing that Lincoln
said.
Attacked. It's a just war. We're the good guys. It's a cause of freedom. We'd have no doubt about that. But then once the war starts, that sort of line of us and them, it's really tough.
It's inherent in the nature of war itself. And I think, you know, when we were making the film, we showed it to a group of advisors. One of them is a military historian, and he said, civilians just don't understand that war itself is obscene, and that's basically the fact of it. So then you feel, well, then, thank goodness it was a justified war, but it's just the fact, the reality of it. And when you hear the people who were there telling you about the things that they did and that they saw, you realize that's what haunts them in a lot of ways.
There was also a bit of betrayal. I was surprised at how General Douglas MacArthur promised to save the soldiers in the Philippines, but then just left them to die and suffer. I'm not sure he could have done anything.
He was actually, in fact, in this case, ordered after a series of just disastrous decisions or lack of decisions on his part to mobilize the forces in the Philippines that would have perhaps maybe only prolonged the inevitable surrender, but it would have given the Japanese more resistance. You know, this was a film in which, like the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, we wanted those big players to just be mentioned, to let them cross distantly on our stage and have it from the point of view, literally, of the people who did the fighting and the dying.
We'll take a break and we'll come back to that. My guests are Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, and we are talking about the war, which began being broadcast on Sunday night and will continue to be broadcast on PBS through its full 7-part, 15-hour length. Stay with us for more.
Thank you.
We're back with Lynn Novick and Ken Burns, who are co-directors and co-producers of the series, the 7-part, 15-hour epic documentary, The War, which is being broadcast on PBS. You may have seen the first on Sunday. Were you thinking about the war in Iraq when you were making this film? Because you started it before
We started it before 9/11. We did most of our interviews before the invasion of Iraq. And yet, and so, and as we've tried to say, that there's not a political bone in this film's body, at the same time, we know that by touching some essential aspects of war through the compelling testimony of these people, it reverberates, it echoes with the present, so that when Sam Hinds said, as you quoted at the head of the show, there's no such thing as a good war, only necessary wars and just wars, that resonates with us as we debate that. As he comments later on about the treatment of prisoners or the implied brutality of enemies versus us, you begin to think, well, what about Abu Ghraib? And so you hear, from the lack of equipment to bad decision-making, the echoes that are common to all war.
Now, Samuel Hinds is a famous academic. Paul Fussell is also in the film. But you present them as just two veterans. In fact, all of the interviewees are presented as just ordinary Americans. Why not give Paul Fussell and Samuel Hinds
There are ringers.
Yeah, we really wanted to focus on the experience that people had who just could tell you what it was like from the point of view of an ordinary person. And we ended up that we had asked Paul Fussell and Sam Hinds to be advisors, and they helped us just understand the war a little bit. But we wanted to tell their combat stories. We wanted to hear what the war was like for them. So, yes, they have a little bit deeper or broader understanding, having thought about it and written about it, but in the film they really talk mostly about their own experience as combat veterans, and so they have a credibility and an authenticity along with everybody else who was there, and that's all. That was our main criterion, frankly.
And the history is told through the stories of people living in four towns in the United States. Why did you decide to use that framing device and relatively small places and no really large cities?
We wanted the randomness of that. We thought initially in our first thinking that we could do it with one town, and we realized, given the horrific triage of actuarial facts of the dying veterans, that we wouldn't have all the combat experience that we thought we needed in one town, and so just ranged out further. And they're geographically distributed: Waterbury, Connecticut; Mobile, Alabama; Sacramento, California, all about 100,000 population at the First World War, all transformed outwardly into war towns, and then tiny Laverne, Minnesota, to get the kind of warp and the weft, the psychological cost, even if there wasn't an apparent physical transformation that took place.
So what did you do? You went into Sacramento and you said, we're going to the veterans of foreign wars. Anybody here who fought in World War II?
Well, we didn't quite know how to go about it at first, frankly, so we sort of flailed around a bit and realized that we could reach out through the local newspapers to say, anyone with a World War II story, please contact us. And we were somewhat deluged, but we quickly sort of narrowed our focus. Anyone who was in combat, please contact us. And that really narrows the scope pretty much. Then we went to the veterans organizations, the local historical societies, people who had connections in the communities that were willing to help us. And it took a while. There was quite a triage process, as Ken was saying, also because Most people who were in World War II were not in combat, and we were primarily interested in what is it like to fight and kill and die, well, or have people die around you. And so we met, 500 or 600 people to pick the 40 or 50 who were in the film. And now, that was, quite challenging.
A city like Mobile allows you to deal with both the white and black experience. But one of the criticisms of the documentary, I'm sure you're tired of talking about this, but still, is that you omitted the contributions of Latino soldiers who disproportionately, compared to the population, served during the war. A little under 1.5% of the population and 500,000 in service. Was that because you didn't go to the right towns?
No, we picked the right towns, most definitely. We didn't tell a lot of stories, and that was not our intention. We did not set out to be definitive. In fact, in front of not just the beginning of the film, but every episode, we have a short disclaimer that says the Second World War was fought in thousands of places, too many
for anyone accounting. This is the story of four American towns and how their citizens experienced that war. And so as we went in there seeking combat experience, that was the main criteria. And of necessity, lots of groups were not in the film, didn't come forward, were greater populations than Hispanics. A lot of experiences or branches of the service were not as well representative or represented at all. We don't have submariners in the film, which we would have loved to have had, but we weren't trying to be all things to all things. But however, we're in the memory and story business, and so we heard and went out and filmed, found a couple of Hispanic veterans who tell us an amazing story, which we divided and put into two places, not one as was requested of us, and added on to the end of our first and the sixth episode, and also gave us the opportunity, since we were gearing up again, to tell an amazing story about a Native American, Joe Medicine Crow. And we had anyway gone to PBS 2 years before this hit the radar screens and said, you know what, this is so partial, this is so arbitrary, and that's its strength, that we need to encourage you to reach out and tell more stories. And so there are 40 more films that PBS has made at a local level. New York has a fabulous one here. Mm-hmm. We've encouraged something like 120 oral history projects. We're doing one with the Library of Congress. And so I think at the end of this process, I think everyone will realize that it's not so much what makes you distinct, but what makes us universal in this. Or to say it better, as Arthur Schlesinger did, there's too much pluribus, not enough unum. And this film is really about the unum, the universal experience of war. We just got back from the Cannes Film Festival, where we just went terrified that our parochial American view might not go over well, and they loved it.
My guests are Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, who are the co-directors and co-producers of the 7-part, 15-hour epic documentary, The War, which is being shown on PBS. Well, since so much of this is about memory, you have to rely on people's memories to be accurate. Did you have a sense that, as is so often the case, people had mythologized their own stories?
Oh, that's an excellent question. We were very mindful of that. And we did our absolute best to verify as much as we possibly could the stories that people were telling us. And that was usually through their own documentation and through their service records, if we could get them, and they're not always available. And then we recognized that sometimes we weren't necessarily dealing with a specific day and something that happened, but more the feeling of what it was like to be shelled, let's say, for example. If somebody was in the infantry and they were in the Battle of the Bulge and they're saying it was total chaos, I think we can pretty much feel comfortable with that kind of a story. And a lot of the things people told us are very experiential. And really, they gave us, you could tell by the way they were describing the things that happened, that because of the way memory works, they were back in that trench, getting, you know, sitting next to a guy who was dead and just being stuck there under fire for a day or something like that. These are very visceral memories that came back to them pretty readily.
Since you also talked to some of the people who remained back home, did the wives say, well, you know, gee, he's been talking about this for years, or were they more likely to say, you know, this is the first time I've ever heard this story?
We had an interesting experience. Quite often, Lynn did one in which somebody said, Pop, you never told us this before. But we had shared with one of our principal folks, a fighter pilot from Laverne, Minnesota, an episode as we were approaching finishing it. And he brought his wife, who is very much part of the film, and their courtship and relationship are a hugely human anchor and kind of contrast to the horrible experiences of battle that he went through. And this is a man who has not been completely silent about it. He has talked and learned to talk about it. And she burst into tears at the end of this episode. And she said that it was so interesting. She said, you know, whenever Quentin would talk about the war, I could always go into the kitchen and wash dishes, meaning she could find a way to just turn it off. And that being, of course, forced to watch a film through manners to be there and to hear it out, she had actually exposed herself to something she had very carefully distanced herself through.
Because she didn't want to know what he'd gone through.
Because she hadn't completely wanted to know about it. And this is a key to understanding, I think, where Lynn and I feel so privileged, which is we have spent these years receiving this memory, trying to verify it, celebrating the fact that sometimes it's the birth of express memory, but more often seeing that for most of these people, they came back from war, they had seen horrible things, they had done horrible things, they had lost good friends. And there was nobody to talk to, and nobody, even those who said, tell us what you did, didn't really want to know.
And we really didn't understand things like post-traumatic stress syndrome.
No. And that is, to me, some of them were, not that everybody who was in the war, you know, suffered from that. That's certainly not true. But you get the sense of this incredible loneliness of coming back, and that people who weren't there just couldn't experience it, and that the culture wasn't prepared to deal with it at all. So if you, for example, went to the psychiatrist and said, I can't sleep, they would just say to you, just act normal. You'll feel normal soon enough. And so what else could they do? They just had to basically, what we would say, they had to suck it up. They just had to go about their lives and kind of put it into place. And some people were able to do that more successfully than others. But no matter how they dealt with it, it becomes sort of part of who they are, obviously. And I think it's been a really interesting process for them as time has gone by to sort of let it out a little bit. And I think that probably some of the symptoms are different than they were when they weren't talking about it.
It's very interesting that someone like Paul Fussell, we were speaking about earlier, who is well known for his writings, actually had a very difficult time in this interview. He is breaking down all the time. This is not a professor in control of the thing,
exactly.
But a 19-year-old, a man who spent his 19th year on the front line in France, didn't take a shower, didn't brush his teeth, didn't change his clothes for 6 months, and whose average life expectancy was 14 days. I mean, you begin to realize that at some point when he accessed that experience, this was no longer some avuncular commentator,
right,
but in fact someone, who, Faulkner said, history is not was but is. He was re-experiencing these moments.
Now, our sense of what happened is also determined by how it was documented.
Right.
You have some amazing footage, I assume, not just American footage, but also Japanese and Russian and
German. Right, British. Yes.
But it... In all wars, there are certain things that where we get more information, and some where we get less. But also, in those days, it was mostly still photos in magazines like Life and movie newsreels. We did not have the soldiers sending back blogs. We didn't have instant reporting. So do we know about this war in a way that we don't know about other wars?
Well, we tried very hard in the film to give a sense of how the people back home were receiving the information, as well as how the soldiers were experiencing it. And you do have a sense of difference. It evolved over the course of the war. So in the beginning, the government was very, very concerned with whether people should know how bad the war was and how bad things were even going for the Americans at first.
And were journalists also censoring themselves because they felt that they would undermine morale?
Exactly. So there's both official censorship, you can't tell who's where and that kind of thing, and then there's essentially everything you say has to be positive and upbeat no matter what the situation. And there's been some great writing by journalists after the war, John Steinbeck, Hemingway, many other writers, about sort of the constraints they felt under to sort of contribute to the war effort and always put the best possible face. And, you know, every GI has to be a hero and everyone has to be brave and no one ever doesn't want to be there and all of that. But it seeps in around the edges. And the most popular correspondent with the troops was Ernie Pyle, because he sort of basically just tried to tell what it's like for the soldiers overseas. And they love that because he was in the trenches with them. And the people back home like that. But then he said after the war that he was always conscious that he could only put in as much of what the war was like as he could up to a certain point without, if he went too far, people back home would want to be basically, you know, want to throw up. So there's always that tension between what the people back home can know. And they know that they don't know the real story. They know they're not getting it, but yet they know they can't know it.
But gradually it evolved, and so the government began to release more.
Right.
They had permitted a photograph to be printed in Life magazine, and then footage, graphic footage from the Battle of Tarawa that really let the cat out of the bag. And then after that, there was more a sense of the participation, whatever the effect. And because there were embedded combat photographers, Signal Corps men and people who are photographers still, as well as motion picture for the Marine Corps, we have an amazing record that is only now beginning to be mined at our own national archives, as well as the sources that we drew on from other places in other countries.
We have very little time left, but I want to touch on one other subject that runs through this series, and that is race. First of all, not just the way black soldiers were segregated in black units, but also the way the enemies were treated differently. The Japanese were much more stereotyped than the Germans in popular culture, and even in the news coverage. I assume to some degree that's a reflection of the internment of Japanese, but not of Italians or Germans.
It's exactly it. And as you know, in other discussions we've had here, I don't think you can actually deal with American history without confronting race, and that with the segregation of African-American troops, with the internment of Japanese citizens, Japanese-American citizens in internment camps, with their being labeled enemy aliens unfit for military service, with the reversal of that to permit them to join only frontline combat duties, with their heroic treatment, you have one of the great stories of the war as an America that is, as Lynn said at the very beginning, it is this watershed moment. It's going to be a huge watershed moment socially. Women are going to ask for things. People are going to be in motion. African Americans are not going to come back. And you still have this unbelievable story of Japanese Americans where you can, your son can give up his life for his country, and the death notice comes to a parent in a relocation camp. And by the way, if they move 1 or 2 degrees to this way, I have to shoot you. I mean, just the idea that your son's given the ultimate sacrifice and you're still under armed guard.
And most Americans were unaware that it was even happening.
Even happening. Or that the service that they did.
Right.
I mean, we know a little bit, and school kids are sometimes taught about the internment, but I mean, we found so many people unaware of that, let alone that the Japanese-American regiment fought with as great a distinction as any other regiment in the history of the United States Army.
I was just going to add that I think it's part of war, too, that it's sort of necessary to dehumanize the enemy for the soldiers to be able to kill the enemy. And when we were in terms of our relationship to the Japanese, that was in a way easier because the Germans were the largest ethnic minority in the United States. So it would be very difficult to dehumanize the Germans. A lot of the guys fighting were of German ethnicity, whereas the Japanese were a much smaller minority, and they seemed more, you know, much more
other
to us, right? So, and they also viewed us the same way, by the way. They had propaganda that made us seem like we were animals and we were subhuman. And so you had this massive sort of cultural misunderstanding between the Japanese and the Americans and in those little islands in the Pacific. It all came to a very, very ugly and brutal end.
We've run out of time, and there's so much more to talk about, but I guess that's why this thing took you 15 hours.
Right. We could go on.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us to talk about this 7-part, 15-hour documentary, The War. Lynn Novick and Ken Burns, co-directors and co-producers of the series.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ken Burns will be in conversation with Robert Stone tomorrow night at 7 at the New York Public Library. For more information about how to get tickets, visit our show page at WNYC.org. And you can also watch a video clip of my conversation with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on our show page. Up next, supermodel Alec Weck describes her family's flight from civil war in Sudan and how she was discovered at a London street fair. Later on, we will find out about some eco-friendly ways to get rid of household pets, take a look at what's happened to 11 leatherback turtles on their annual migration, and then we'll be visited by Joy Behar, who'll have advice for getting through life's rough patches. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.